This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we are speaking with Wade Bean, a corporate partner at the Kunzer Law Group here in Salt Lake City. Wade is what's known in the legal field as a transaction attorney. He makes deals happen. Whether it's a first-time funding for a startup, a major acquisition, or even an IPO. In every case, companies and investors need attorneys like Wade to make sure the deals go through and that all the legal issues are properly addressed. This might seem relatively simple and administrative in nature, but it is anything but that. A good transaction attorney often makes the difference between a deal getting done or it not getting done, between issues being resolved or issues being amplified, and most importantly, between future partners going forward with happy hearts or going forward with bitterness. Utah is fortunate to have several very strong transaction attorneys, and Wade is certainly among the best of them. Join us today to hear Wade's view on critical decisions companies, founders, and investors make along their journey. Normally, his advice would cost hundreds of dollars an hour, so take advantage of this morning's conversation. Wade Bean of Kunzer Law Group, welcome to The Bottom Line.
Thanks, Doug. Great to be here.
So let's start off by talking about the type of work you do. I mentioned a little bit about what a transaction attorney does. Give a little more color to that.
So there's a broad category of transaction attorneys that do everything from, you know, anytime there's a business deal happening, transaction attorneys can get involved. They're anything from real estate, commercial deals, finance, corporate. So within the broader umbrella of transactional work, you'll find a group of attorneys that specialize in corporate. Corporate is, you know, the business of running a business, taking money from investors, and, you know, doing the things that you need to do to be compliant with the laws.
So a major corporation does a loan with a local bank or a national bank, and you would help them on either side of that. You could be on either side of that transaction.
If it's a transaction as specific as a loan, you may have an attorney that works just on loans that will do that transaction. So that still falls within transactional, but I wouldn't say that that is a corporate transaction. A corporate transaction is more when you're dealing with the ownership structure of the company. When investors come in and they say, hey, I want to take a piece of this thing. I want to own part of this company. What does that look like? And, you know, there's different phases where that transaction takes place very early on through the growth stage. And then even when they go public and they're selling their stock to, you know, on the stock market, those transactions as well fall within the corporate realm, I would say.
Okay. So larger companies here in Utah that folks have heard of, Domo, Inside Sales, Qualtrics, those are the types of examples you're giving here. What about a guy's got an idea, he starts pursuing it, he starts getting a little bit of traction, and somebody offers him seed funding? Does an entrepreneur at that stage, would you suggest that they get an attorney like yourself involved?
And that's a great question. And so what I was aiming to differentiate is within corporate, there's also, you know, attorneys that practice on very different stages of the growth life cycle, I would say. So you have late stage attorneys that work with post IPO companies and large law firms that, you know, help them comply with all of the regulations. And then you have early stage attorneys like myself that help companies well before they're, you know, listed on a public stock market or well before they, you know, have, you know, really complex systems in place and help them with their growth, help them get started, help them get money from investors that are helping them get started, and then taking them through that life cycle of, you know, how do we start with, you know, who owns what, when the money comes in, what do they get, and then take it from there.
Well, let's start with that. And what I thought how we'd structure the interview is really just go through the various stages of growth and the legal issues that are involved in those. And so the example I mentioned earlier, somebody's got a good idea, they start exploring it, seeing if they can get some traction, they start to get some positive feedback from the market, they say, you know, this might actually be a business. Instead of talking to my friends about it, maybe I actually want to offer it to the public. And oftentimes I'll have people ask me, do I need to be an LLC? Do I need to be an S-Corp? Can I just do this on my own? How do you think about advising them? Because there is complexity and there is cost in all those decisions.
That's right. And I think you've said it well. Every company will have a potential path that it wants to follow. Some companies are going to follow it's just going to be a family-run company or a closely held company. We're not going to take a lot of outside money. This thing is going to cash flow pretty soon. And we're just, you know, it's not going to be the next Google, but it's going to be a nice business for within its realm. So that's one path. Another path might be, hey, I've got a fantastic idea. I think this thing could really change, you know, the way telecom or the way software works or the way search works. And so I want to make this something really big and really game changing. But that's going to take a lot of money to get there. So then that entrepreneur might think about a different path where they're going to go start right out of the gate trying to raise funds from outside investors. And those investors were going to be the angel investors and then later on venture capitalists. And they're going to follow quite a different trajectory than a company that just wants to start up a little bit of capital, maybe a loan from a bank. And they're going to, you know, cash flow and not looking for huge explosive growth like right. You would with a software or a technology company.
And in either one of those examples, I would think the entrepreneur wants to protect himself or herself from as much of the liability of running a company as possible.
That's right.
Is that a main reason that you see entrepreneurs come to you and say, hey, I want to set up some structure, some legal entity? Is one of the primary motivations for that liability protection? And how good is that liability protection? Can you actually protect yourself from a lot of the liability?
It's another good question. I think there's a few reasons why you would want to set up an entity for your business. One of them, of course, is liability protection. We can touch on that a little bit. But I think just to go down the list, the other one is to create a separate entity that will own the business rather than an individual. So let's say that my business is a cool whiz-bang software that I'm going to put up on the internet and make available and sell to people. Well, if it's just me and I'm the only person involved, you know, maybe I do, maybe I don't need an entity. But as soon as I bring somebody else into the picture, either an investor, a partner that is going to work with me, whoever it might be, I need an entity that owns that business, that owns the technology, in addition to the liability protection it provides. So that's, another one of the primary reasons of the entity is to say, who owns what? Rather than just me, the entrepreneur, owning everything, you know, we have to divide it up and we have to also make sure that anybody that isn't the primary actor in the business, that they're protected, that the business itself that they're putting their money into owns what they think it owns.
If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Wade Bean, a corporate partner and transaction attorney at the Kunzer Law Group. So Wade, one of the reasons I thought this would be an interesting conversation to share with our audience is I have the good fortune of being able to go to lunch and meet with folks like yourself fairly regularly. And I often find myself thinking, boy, it'd be nice if there was a way to disseminate some of this information, because I always leave learning something new. And, how do you disseminate that to a broader audience? And that's really my goal here is to share some of this. So, and one of the key things that I see entrepreneurs stumble on is they don't get somebody like yourself involved early. It's not unusual, maybe three or four college guys or, some folks that have been out working 5-6 years decide to start a company. They get together, they have dinner, and they say, okay, we're going to own the company and we each own 20% of the company. Those are big decisions that were just made on the fly over dinner and have huge ramifications for that company, right? How much does each entrepreneur own? Is there vesting involved? Is there not vesting involved? And let's talk to the audience about the vesting. So in that situation, five folks getting together, they want to start a business. I just mentioned the term vesting. Share with our audience what that is and why, if you're going into business, starting something new with a group of other people, you want everybody vesting, including yourself.
So vesting, just to take a step back and understand that concept, is where I hold a portion of the business. You know, let's say that you and I go into business and we're going to split this 50-50, or your example, four people split it 25%. When I own that, if I decide the very next day that I'm done and I want to leave and go do something else, the question is, do I continue to own that? And if we don't do any sort of vesting, investing is where my ownership is subject to some requirements for me to retain that. Usually that requirement is time. I need to serve time with the company. And if I leave before I've met those requirements, then vesting is the concept where what has not vested goes back to the company. So let's take my example. We decide we're in college. We decide to split up this business. It's got a great business, you know, great potential. I get an offer from Google a week later, and I decide to go take it. Well, now we're down to, let's use my example, just you. So you're holding 50% of this business. I own 50% of this business. I just left, and you're sitting there wanting to make this happen. And so now the question is, if you do make this happen, should I reap the benefits of your labors when I've, you know, spent a week at the company and own half of it? So if I place vesting on myself and vesting on you, then it's an agreement between you and I that says, look, we understand that if we both are committed to this company and we both serve our time and put in the effort, then we're both going to, at the end of the day, split this thing 50-50. But based on the time that we've served, if you decide to go do something else, or if I decide to go do something else, then it's going to work out, because the shares or the ownership that I would have otherwise retained is forfeited back to you, because I did not serve my time. I did not put in the effort, and you know, I'm off earning income in another source. So yeah, that's the concept.
It's a critical concept. I think at the onset, it feels fair to both parties. And yet you and I probably both run into entrepreneurs every year that are in a situation where they didn't do that day one. And right. Now they have a really complicated, frustrating situation. And the person that did not vest certainly doesn't feel that concept is fair at that point. So that's one of the big reasons these type of topics is what I wanted to share with a broad audience that a lot of folks know, but a lot of folks don't know. And I think it's important to get the word out there.
Absolutely. And I will add this, that because vesting is such an important concept, if an institutional or well-seasoned investor comes into your company and wants to put money into it, they're going to want to know that there's vesting involved as well. So if you haven't already set some vesting parameters around what you own and your other partners own, they're going to insist on it. So and sometimes it's in many cases, it's in your benefit to set those terms up front before you go ask for money, because when you go ask for money, then they're going to ask you to do the vesting the way that they want it done, rather than the way that you would have otherwise agreed with your partner.
Yeah. What about, I'm going to bring up a topic that's a little more controversial. What about non-competes? So, you know, California, pretty much non-enforceable. Utah is a very pro-business state, very enforceable. What are some guidelines that you think founders should know when they're thinking about bringing people onto their team for non-competes, as well as for an employee thinking about, is this okay? You know, is it okay for me to sign something like this? Is it too restrictive?
So non-competes, as you pointed out, common in Utah, certainly not in California, and anybody that has employees in California should not have any non-compete language in any of their agreements. But if it's a Utah employee or a lot of other states in this area, because it is common, I think what you realize is that most people have become comfortable with it. But what I think people should understand is, what does that mean? Usually when you sign a non-compete, and you decide to go somewhere else, if it's an amicable departure, the company that has you under the non-compete, your soon-to-be former employer, will give you the opportunity to go find gainful employment elsewhere, and they'll be fine, you know, giving you some sort of waiver of that non-compete. Usually when you run into trouble with a non-compete is when you, as the employee, organize a coup, you know, and you decide to go sneak out and go work for a competitor or maybe take some other employees with you. That's when you run into trouble, and that's when it's important to know what the potential ramifications are of that decision.
Let's take a quick break, and then we'll talk some more with Wade Bean, a corporate partner at the Kunzer Law Group. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Wade Bean, a corporate partner at the Kunzer Law Group. Wade specializes in helping high-growth and technology companies with their financing and related transactions. So the non-competes before break we were talking about. I have an entrepreneur, very talented, just a brilliant guy. He can connect dots in ways most people can't and come up with new ways of solving problems. He was a California employee. He left, and the employer said, you know, your laptop's old. Just go ahead and keep it, right? And he didn't have a non-compete, but that was used as a basis to kind of drag him into, oh, did any of this new technology come from the old technology? So I share this example of simple things that can really get you, can get make your life complex. You know what? Just go buy a new laptop. Spend a couple $100, $1,000 and buy a new laptop. Don't take your company's old computer. Because not only is it a non-compete, but you obviously can't take their proprietary information with you.
And the concept of proprietary information is what California companies use to get around this restriction on non-competes. So if you even though I can't tell my former employee, hey, you can't go work for a competitor, I'm still able to require them when they're working for me to tell me that they're not going to misappropriate my confidential information, my technology, my IP. So what you find in practice is when a key employee does go to work for a competitor even in California, the former employer will sometimes send a warning shot to the new employer and saying, hey, there's a strong chance that unless you're really careful, this employee that you just hired is going to potentially misappropriate confidential information of us, their former employer. And so that's a way to get the same effect of preventing people from doing bad things that would otherwise be in violation of a non-compete, even though there is no non-compete in place.
Let's talk about some other things that sometimes tangle people up in ways they wouldn't have thought of ahead of time. And some of these are going to be controversial again, so I apologize. But one of the things I find with entrepreneurs is with their first couple transactions, they may not fully understand who the attorney is working for. So you're the founder, you're the CEO of a company, you hire an attorney to help you do a financing. In this case, I think it's important for the entrepreneur to know in the situation I just described, the attorney works for the company, not for the founder of the company. And why is that important for the founder to know?
There are situations where the founder's interests don't align with the interests of the overall company. And in those situations, I think you've made a good point that the founder may not understand that distinction. So anytime a company hires counsel, if you read the engagement letter carefully with the attorney, it'll say that the company is the client and not you, the founder. And so what that means is representing the company is representing all of the interests, all of the stakeholders, all of the stockholders, the board, everybody equally, and not favoring one stockholder, one party, one executive over the best interests of the entire company. And sometimes, you know, when you're negotiating, I don't know, an equity incentive plan or renegotiating salary, or the executive that actually called up the attorney and hired them to come work for them, when they have an issue that divert, you know, let's say the company wants to have them renegotiate their package or have them sign a non-compete, for example. In that situation, it's in the company's interest to have that person sign the non-compete or restructure their equity, but the founder that originally called the attorney to come work for them doesn't understand that the attorney is actually working for the company and not for them. When that founder says, "Hey, can you help me negotiate this? The board really wants me to sign this thing, and I don't want to sign it. You know, you're my guy. Help me out."
And attorneys are great about being very upfront and candid about it, but you have to ask.
Yeah.
You know, and a question I tell entrepreneurs to always ask when you're in a room with attorneys is, you know, who's your fiduciary obligation to?
Right.
And it's really important that everybody knows who the attorneys are working for.
And this becomes especially important when there's investors that have already invested in the company, and then the company needs some additional capital or they need something to happen. And sometimes those investors don't understand that either, where the company counsel doesn't represent them in particular, that they represent all of the interests of all shareholders, even though those investors may hold a large stake, and even though they may have a controlling interest on the board, it's still the counsel's responsibility to represent all shareholders and all stakeholders in the company.
Okay. Now I said I was going to kind of structure this by growth of the company. So we've gone through the early stage. Now you're starting to hire some senior folks on your team. So now you're the one asking the new people to sign the non-competes, to sign the other legal documents. And one of the big things, you know, the way startups and high growth companies attract high quality talent is with options. What are some things that founders should think about as they look at their option pool, and what are some legal issues about options that you think founders should know about, and maybe when you talk with company employees, maybe they don't understand about options?
So just to be clear, do you mean from the company's perspective when the company is trying to decide whether to create an option pool, or whether you're talking about a potential employee who's looking at, hey, I'm getting offered an option, what do I need to think about as I'm going to join that company?
Good question. Actually, I have both. Let's start first with the company perspective.
Yeah. So investors in doing a transaction will want to know investors doing a transaction with you, the entrepreneur, will want to know that the company has the ability to give equity incentives to new employees. Options. So, as you know, an option is the ability to buy stock at a certain fixed price sometime in the future. And so that fixed price is going to be set based on what the value is now. But hopefully in a few years, the value of that stock is going to be much, much more, you know, much, much greater. And so now you've created a big spread between, you know, what it's worth and what you're going to have to pay for it. And that's a value to you, the employee. So companies will grant options to employees going forward to give them incentives. And the entrepreneur needs to know that that is part of the package that the investors will require you to have in your company, and that new employees will expect to get when they come, you know, that are seasoned new employees that you're making hires in a very competitive space right now are going to expect you to give them stock options. And the way that actually plays out that the entrepreneurs don't quite understand is that if an investor comes in and says, okay, we're going to invest and we want to own 10% of your business and we're going to give you $1 million. What they don't understand sometimes is that included in that, the investors will say, and we want you to create an option pool, is a term of art, and that option pool needs to be 15% of the fully diluted.
Which is basically just a set aside.
It's a set aside.
For options that you're going to grant in the future to attract these talented people.
That's right. So, but what you need to understand about that, when they're asking you to create an option pool of, say, 15%, that you, the founder, or you and your other co-founders are going to take the dilution of that 15%. The investor will not take the dilution for that 15% when they put their money in. They want their 10% to have already included that 15% option pool that you've created. So It's a way for the investors to prevent future dilution by those options being granted, you know, within a year or two of when they put their money
in. You look
in.
At the company and you say, we know we're going to have to hire these people in the future. You should have had this already.
Exactly.
You don't, so let's set it aside. You know, where things get complicated, and I think this has a broad theme to it that applies to the general audience that's listening, is you would think an entrepreneur wants to get the highest valuation for his company at every step along the way. And that makes intuitive sense, but as many things are in life, it's more complex than that, right? If you get too high of a valuation today, how are you going to bump the valuation? It's going to be a lot harder to bump the valuation in 6 months, 12 months, 2 years when you do your next round. There's that. And then you also have to think about the people that are going to be coming into your company. Your option price is going to be largely set, or is certainly going to be heavily influenced by the valuation of your last arm's length transaction.
That's right.
So you mentioned an option is the right to buy some of the company in the future for a set price today. The way that set price gets set, you want that to be as low as possible for your employees, so it's as attractive, it has as much upside for people. But the way that also gets set and is influenced is by your pre-money valuation of your last round. Have you seen where that's created issues for companies where maybe they've gotten ahead of themselves on the valuation and now it's harder to attract people?
I actually see that more often when some of the earlier founders or earlier investors are getting liquidity in a round than you do with the round itself. To understand the context of that, usually the option strike price, as you said, which needs to equal the fair market value, is done at a considerable discount to the price that the investors paid. So let's say the investors bought their shares at $1 a share, this preferred stock that has all these rights. So the company is able to issue an option to an employee at a discount to that dollar a share because of certain factors. It's common stock. It doesn't have all the preferences. And so let's say that the common stock is valued at 50 cents a share. Well, that's normally how it goes. And if, you know, the valuation may get pushed up and in, you know, let's say that it's double that and the strike price for your options is $1 instead of 50 cents. Well, that's less of an issue typically than when a founder says, I want to go sell some of my common stock in connection with this round, but I don't want to take the 50 cents that we're issuing options at. I want 90 cents, or I even want $1 a share for my common stock similar price to what the investors are paying for their preferred shares. And so that's where you see the big issue is.
And then
when
they mess up the discount for everybody else.
They mess up the discount because, hey, here's an arm's length transaction where a founder is selling his or her shares to investors for 90 cents or $1 a share. And out of the very, you know, few weeks after the transaction closes, we're going to issue new options to a new employee and we're going to say that it's worth 50 cents a share when we just sold it for 90 cents a share.
Yeah.
And so that's where you run into trouble is, you know, it's usually okay to discount off of the preferred, but it's really hard to discount common off of a common transaction.
Yeah,
exactly. And yeah. Common's arm length transaction.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Wade Bean, a corporate partner at the Kunzer Law Group. So we're talking about option pricing and options in general. And I think it's getting much more commonplace for more and more people to have options as we have more of these fast-growing, successful companies here in Utah. And it's a wonderful thing. It's a great way to not only get paid a fair salary for your work along the way, but hopefully share in some of that upside and spread that wealth of the successful companies that are being created here. So more and more people find themselves with options. I think a lot of people don't fully understand some of the details, and we're talking about it gets complex very quickly. I apologize for that. Another high-level concept with options for folks that, you know, maybe are not part of the senior executive team, they're part of the core team, but is easy to overlook is if you choose to leave the company, you have a limited amount of time to exercise those options, and you typically have to come out of pocket with a fair amount of cash to exercise those options.
That's right.
Talk to folks about that and why that might be important for the average middle-class American family.
Well, I think the idea is that when you're thinking about leaving a company, you put in time into this. You know, let's say you're 2 years in, and you've got a bunch of vested options. I think the concern is that typically only the people that are in the seat, that are at the company when the company exits, will participate in that liquidity. And so even though an employee has put in a considerable amount of work and effort and helped build the company, but then they go take another opportunity before the company goes and sells, usually people, as you point out, don't have the means to exercise an option. When I say exercise, I mean buy the shares that option allows you to buy, because they have a very limited amount of time. And so a lot of people write off or, you know, just walk away from those the potential upside that they helped create because
they
weren't around.
If they had options in Apple stock, just to use an example.
Right.
That would be a much different situation, because they could sell some of those shares to pay for the options.
Right.
If they have options in a private company, why is that different, and why is that more of a financial burden?
Great point. Because a private company, before it's publicly traded, like Apple, which most startups are, you know, most startups are not publicly traded, you have very limited ability to sell your shares to anybody else until the company is sold and one buyer or, you know, an investor comes in and buys up all the shares at the same time. And so there isn't a market for your shares. If you exercise your option and you can't, you know, you turn around, okay, well, who's going to buy this now? Do I just sit on it? And, is this company actually going to succeed? Maybe it's not. It's still the jury's still out. And so there's a lot of hesitancy for people that are leaving before a company is sold to exercise options, even though they've been a very key part of that. Yeah. If they leave before the eventual exit.
I just want to add a tiny bit more color, and then we'll move on to another topic. And that color is, let's say you have options at 10 cents a share, and they're now worth $1 a share, and you have the right to exercise. You've vested in 1 million shares. That's a great thing, right?
Right.
You have to come out of pocket, for $100,000.
That's right.
But you now own an asset that theoretically is worth $1 million. You want to be doing that, but it's not liquid. First off, do you have $100,000?
Exactly.
And do you think it's going to be worth $1 million? And how long do you have to wait until you get that money? So it's a big issue. I know the firms and many high growth companies in California are working on this, trying to figure out what the solution is. I think Utah still has some work to do on it. I see very standard. You've got 90 days to exercise your options. It's got to be for cash. It's not very employee friendly, and I'd like to see that become more employee friendly down the road.
Right. And unfortunately, a lot of those are set by the IRS. So there's regulations around that 90 days, which is an IRS rule rather than something that has been set by the market.
I didn't know that. So that's going to make it more challenging. Hopefully there's a solution. You guys,
right.
You attorneys are very clever. I'm sure there's a way around that. Let's go to the other side, and I want to get to the later stage companies before we end the interview. But let's go to the other side. We've pretty much taken the company and the founder perspective. Let's take the perspective of you're a successful executive. You're in a stable job. You're doing really well. One of your buddies from college is leading a high growth company, is recruiting you to leave your stable, secure job and
right.
join this high growth company. And that type of individual calls you, Wade, and says, "Hey, Wade, I've been offered this opportunity. I want you to represent me." What types of things would you want to look at in that contract, that offer, to protect your client, the person leaving the secure job?
So these are questions that come up quite a bit. I think there's two pieces of a typical package that an employee would look at when they're going to join a startup. One piece is what we've already touched on, which is the non-compete, non-solicitation, confidential information restrictions around your engagement with the company. you know, are you signing a non-compete? What does it say? How restrictive is it? What are the, what's the geography? All those things. So you have to be very careful, because they've, even though you say one company requires you to sign a non-compete, all companies require you to sign a non-compete, there is a difference in what those terms say and how restrictive they are. So that's on one side of it, is, you know, what are your ongoing restrictions? The other side of it is, what does your equity look like? Everyone knows what salary looks like. Everyone has that concept down really well, and bonus. But what does your equity look like? Because when you're going to take a position, the reason you leave your big, well-paying, stable job is so that you can, you know, as most people would say, because they want to participate in the upside. They want their bite of the apple, and they want to have that equity. So the terms of your option are going to be very key. So when you're walking through what are those terms, the most important, of course, is what are you getting? You know, how many shares of what? You know, so they offer you, hey, here's 100,000 shares of my company. You're thinking, wow, that's fantastic, 100,000 shares. But what you don't know is that 100,000 shares of a million shares? Or is that 100,000 shares of a trillion shares? You know, and so you can see how that would play out. And sometimes I've been surprised how many times employees that come to me with these questions don't even understand what that number is of the bottom line, you know, what they're getting. So that's the first one. The second one is, as we talked about earlier, vesting. There's a wide variety of vesting. And vesting acceleration. And acceleration is a concept that a senior executive would want to understand, where if they leave under certain conditions, let's say the company fires them rather than them leaving, or let's say that a year into their vesting, when it's, you know, maybe a 4-year term, a year into your vesting, the company finds a buyer and it sells. You know, do you get the full credit for that full 4 years of all your shares, or do you only get credit for the 1 year you served up to that point? You know, so there's some concepts around that you would discuss with your attorney about what kind of acceleration do you want, what does the vesting schedule look like, and what are your protections if you're fired when you didn't do something bad. When they fired you, it was kind of out of your hands, you left your well-paying job, you took some risk, do you get some additional compensation in that situation?
Yeah, and these can have huge impacts, particularly.
That's right.
Particularly the let's say the company's launching a new line, you're the leader of it, and you've done a great job, but they just decide it's not strategic for them.
That's right. Cut off
that line. Well, you should still get something for that. It shouldn't be like you quit, right?
Right.
And then the forward vesting—that's a good thing if a company gets bought early. But if you're not careful, you may find yourself with only half of your stock vested instead of all of it.
And that's out of your hands. It wasn't because of
poor performance. It's a good outcome and it's out. Yeah,
that's right.
And it should be a good outcome for everybody.
It should be a good outcome for you. That's right.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so you mentioned, we were talking about the company getting bought out. Let's go up the growth cycle some more. So now the company's doing well. Different people are that company is catching the attention of potential acquirers. I think entrepreneurs, it's a compliment when somebody calls you up, a business development person from one of the bigger companies. Hey, you know, we're interested in finding out more. We might be interested in buying you guys. That's a compliment, right? It's outside validation.
That's right.
It's also about to suck up a lot of your time. How should a founder think about, should they entertain having these discussions? When's the right time to start thinking about that? And how do you balance the time demands that are included with that?
The interesting thing about this question is that it's going to depend on who's around the table of your, you know, your investor group, your shareholders, your board. You as a founder may have a certain idea, you know, that, no, I want this thing, I want to ride this thing out, I want to see this thing all the way through, and I want this to be the next Facebook. But your investors that you took money from earlier on when you needed cash and to grow and to get to this point, they may be on a different time clock. They, one thing you'll need to understand about the investors that put money into your company is, what are their requirements to get that money back out? You know, do they need to get it back out quickly?
And you have that conversation before you take their money day one.
Yes. And sometimes, you know, so you should understand that going into that negotiation with your investor group. But, you know, as you say, do you entertain that offer? Really, that will depend on what does everyone else around the table want you to do. You know, if you're the founder and the CEO, unfortunately, even though it is quote unquote your company and it's your baby, you have to consider all of the interests of all the other shareholders and particularly those on the board. And so, again, they may be on a different time horizon. They may say, it's time. We need to entertain these offers. And I've seen a lot of disagreements on this about timing. Is the valuation right? When some people say, look, we're just tired of this. We're tired of support. You know, when I say that, I mean the investors. Some investors are saying, we're tired of supporting this. You know, you've been bleeding cash. We've had to keep putting money back in. We're done. We just need to get out and cut our losses. Or, you know, just, you know, maybe it's not a home run, but maybe we just, you know, get a little bit of our money back out. When you're willing to see this thing through. And so that's when you see some differences of opinion. So I guess the first response to that question would be, go talk to your board. And then, you know, I think any offer is worth listening to, of course. But it's just a question of whether it's worth spending a lot of time on, because your time is limited.
And that's the quandary, right? Unfortunately, right. These things take up a lot of time. And sometimes you see really interesting companies where everybody's on board and they think they want to go a couple more years. But, hey, it's worth seeing. Well, let's see what the offer comes in at.
Right.
Right. And that can that can be a huge distraction. And I've found that can be a mistake.
And to keep going with that thought, there's a strong possibility that some of your offers or what look like offers are actually fishing expeditions from potential competitors, where they want to say, hey, let's see if we can get these guys to give us some more information about what they're doing. We may be interested in buying them, but what I'm really after is I want to kind of look behind the curtain and see what's going on there, and so if we can get some.
So how do you protect yourself from that?
Well, I mean, you have to know. You really have to feel the situation out. There's agreements you can put in place around that, and of course, go talk to your corporate counsel anytime that is on the table. So you can put some confidentiality agreements and things like that. But really, you just have to know your buyer. You have to get to know them and know what they're after. Know their, you know, do some back channel work on, you know, their board, on who their investors are, if there are any, and see what their track record is with this sort of thing.
So let's keep going with that theme of acquisition. So let's say you entertain the offer. The company says, hey, we are going to put in an offer. Here's what it looks like. What does that process usually look like for a company? Let folks, it's some, most of us don't have the opportunity to experience. What is that experience like?
Putting in getting an offer from a company that's
and making it happen.
Yeah. So it's a lot of work. I think everyone should understand that you need to be emotionally ready for it, because it's going to require a lot of work, a lot of ups and downs. So you start off with, there's that first dance of you get to know each other and, you know, you go to meetings, and this sometimes takes a while. Eventually you will get an offer sheet or a letter of intent or MOU. You know, there's a variety of names it's called, but it's basically 2 to 10 page.
Non-binding. Here's outline of what we think it's going to look like.
Here's what we think we want the deal to look like, and you kind of negotiate that. And once you've gotten to a point where everyone agrees on that, including your board, then now you're in the mode of, okay, now we're going to make this deal happen. And then they're going to come in and they're going to ask you to really just, like I said, pull back the curtain. Show you have to show them where all the bodies are buried in, and show them all of your operating history, a lot of your corporate documents, all of your, they're going to do customer calls and validation and things like that. So it's a real process where they're going to invade you and make you feel like, you're getting every part of your business, examined and scrutinized. And it's sometimes painful and certainly takes a lot of effort.
Okay. I'm going to pause you there. I want to go back. We talked about the letter of intent, and there's some important things you should be doing before you get to the letter of intent stage. First, you should have an attorney like yourself involved way early, because as the seller of the company, that's as good as it's going to get. Letter of intent. Everything's going to be taken off the table from them.
That's right.
And I've seen with smaller companies, particularly family-held companies, I work with a fair number of high-net-worth families that have built their wealth through building companies. And we do have a do-it-yourself mentality here in Utah, which has a lot of advantages and a lot of strengths to it. Dealing with selling your company is not a time you want to be putting on your do-it-yourself hat.
That's
right. It's a time you want to get an attorney involved early, oftentimes even a couple years early, just to kind of what types of things should I be thinking about. In particular, there's some estate planning things that you can do before it's clear that there's going to be a sale. And that's a topic for another show. But the attorney should be involved well before the letter of intent. And I think a lot of folks' intuition says, let me get to the letter of intent, and then I'll get an attorney involved. Give a little color. Why is it important that you're involved before the letter of intent?
There will be things when in the letter of intent that you don't really understand, and you look at, you know, they're going to flash a really high number at the top of the letter, and they're going to say, you know, we're going to buy you for $20 million or $200 million based on all these conditions. As you dig further into it, you'll realize that there's things that could happen that will bring that number down considerably. They may ask you to keep some of that in escrow and not, you know, you won't get it until other certain conditions happen. Anyway, there's a lot of different ways that what looks like a certain dollar amount can be much less than that in actuality. So that's what attorneys do all day long, is they negotiate these things. And so you need their advice on that. And then even going back further, before you get into that process where you're negotiating this letter, having an attorney help you avoid potential liability and risk as an acquirer comes in, when they go do that process where they examine all your books and they examine all your processes and your contracts and your, you know, issues with your employees, when they identify things that aren't in order, they will use that as a reason to knock down the price that you're going to get. And so the less of those issues that they identify in that diligence process, the more likely you are to get a higher price for when you sell. So if you have an attorney help you along the way, avoid those things, and discussion with your attorney will help you identify what those potential issues are, the more likely it is that you're going to keep that high price that you think you're going to get when you're going into the deal negotiation.
Yeah, great points. One that I would add as well is, hopefully you have a couple firms that are interested in buying your company, and there's a moment in time where companies maintain their interest. So making sure that there's a timeline, how long do we have for this process? And if you don't firm it up and if we don't close it, hey, because you're going to be under a no shop, you're going to be where you can't talk to other people during that period of time. So there's all these examples of why you want to get a professional attorney helping you early in the process. So let's go, we mentioned earlier what the process looks like after the term sheet. Mm-hmm. Anything else you want to add, the kind of gotchas that you've seen folks stumble on that maybe they should know about?
Accounting is always a big one, and you know, your attorneys may not see a lot of that, but you know, usually it's around accounting issues. And so I think, you know, that's when you're talking about how to prepare, you know, get good your books in order well before you're going to go sell.
That's something exactly you should be doing years ahead of time.
Right.
Hopefully.
Then, you know, employee issues, and then there's always just the intellectual property issues when we're talking about tech companies. Are there potential holes in your ownership, and what could you have done before then to shore those up? I think what I would say as well is, if you have all of your, you mentioned this concept of deal momentum or deal heat. You know, when you've got a lot of interest from several buyers and there's competition, the further you are along the path of preparing your company for that exit, and by that I mean get all of your stuff cleaned up. Have your accountants and your attorneys cleaning this stuff up, keeping it up to date well before you enter this process. Allows you to respond quickly when you are in that mode of getting a lot of interest from competing parties. Because if you have to call a timeout on the deal and go fix stuff, you know, go fix your accounting, go fix your, you know, your corporate and legal and, you know, your equity ownership, that's gonna slow the momentum down. That's gonna take some of the heat off of the deal, and you may lose the potential buyer.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Wade Bean, a corporate partner at the Kunzer Law Group. We're talking about deal heat. We're talking about the final stages of a company. You've grown it. It's successful. It's time to exit. I mentioned in the open, Wade, that some folks may view transactional attorneys as, you know, kind of a it's a necessity that needs to be done. I also shared that the difference between, I call you guys a deal attorney, and I mean that yeah. as a compliment. The difference between a good deal attorney and a mediocre deal attorney is a good one makes it happen. And
right.
a mediocre or a bad one can actually kill your deal.
That's right.
How do people get a sense for, is this an attorney that's going to help me get things, get this deal done, or is this somebody that's going to get caught up on details that maybe don't move the needle?
I think the best way to do that is to have some track record with your counsel before you go into a deal. If you're hiring counsel, it's really hard to, just like when you hire somebody, it's better to have somebody work as an intern for you for a little while before you know how they work. So if you have a track record with your counsel, if you're going to swap counsel out, you know, and you're going to have issues with them and they don't work well with you and they're not helping you close deals, you want to identify that well before you're in the process of putting, you know, the transaction together. So that's why get counsel involved with your business along the way, in between the points where you normally would think to do it, in between the financing and the exit, in between when you're doing this big debt deal and when, you know, when there's a recap. So you want to have counsel involved. And, you know, a lot of good corporate attorneys will do a lot more than just do your transaction. They'll help you with your commercial agreements. They'll help you, they'll help with the board process. They'll help you with employment stuff. So get your counsel involved so that they know your business and that you know their working style. And if it doesn't fit, go find new counsel before you get into the deal.
The idea of fit is really important, and this the art of the deal. And so, Wade, it's one of the things I like about you. I mean, my sense is you have a nice intuitive sense for the art of the deal. We've had Gavin Christensen on as a guest. I know you do a lot of work with Kickstart Seed Fund. That's a big compliment.
Right.
But the understanding the art of the deal, and you know, candidly, I think it's an unnatural thing for a lot of attorneys because I think a lot of folks get into it because they love debate,
right?
You know, when they're in high school or college, and so much of these complicated transactions have a big piece of relationship in it. It's not
That's
about
right.
winning a point; it's about getting to that finishing line for both parties.
And I've seen deals happen or deals fall apart because of exactly the situation you point out, where counsel wasn't willing to take a step back and accept a limited amount of risk going into this. They, you know, investor counsel on a transaction I was representing the company on kept hounding the company on these small points that were not, they weren't winning any economic points in hounding on these things. It was kind of the counsel posturing, if you will. And the company got so fed up with it, they said, okay, deal's off. And then when the investors came back to the table a few months later, the company's valuation had gone up by 20-30% at that point. And so it really hurt the investors, the attitude, the approach that their counsel took towards the company and the company's counsel. So I think there is it's an important art. You'll find that a lot of people that do repeat business in the area, and by repeat business, I mean it's a small community. We see transactions with a lot of the same parties over and over again. And so when you get a feel for how people operate and people that have worked in that space for a while, they'll know, they'll have a good sense for what are the issues that we actually do need to call time out on and get hung up on and push back on and dig our heels on. And what are the ones where it's like, look, this isn't actually going to hurt you. Let's not raise any major issues with this one. Let's just get this deal done, because if you don't get this deal done, the consequences of not doing it are much worse than the risk that this small issue may present.
Yeah, that's a great advice, and it's a great point for us to pause on talking about kind of the deal and the companies. And I want to wrap up with a few minutes about just your personal journey.
Yeah.
How did you decide, hey, I think law's going to, we have probably a lot of young people in the audience that are thinking, you know, law might be interesting. They've heard you talk today. It sounds like interesting work. Yeah. How did you decide that this was work that you wanted to do, and how is reality compared to that?
So I never actually thought I was going to be an attorney until I was an attorney. Started out of school working for a strategy and economic consulting firm. My background in undergraduate is economics, and so I worked for a firm that
from BYU, right?
We'll put BYU
the plug out there.
Yeah, okay. BYU, and worked for a firm in Boston called Charles River Associates, where they, you know, had a wide variety of things that you could do with your economic background, and that was really exciting for me. So, you know, I tried my hand at some antitrust work, some transfer pricing work, and then I really found my groove in a group of aerospace and defense consultants. And this was about the time when the aerospace industry was really going through a lot of turmoil with, you kind of had these dumb tanks and bombs and jets, and you had all this technology that these contractors were layering into it. And so we spent a lot of our time evaluating small technology companies that these big, you know, tank manufacturers and shipbuilders were buying up in order to apply to their big structures. And so in doing that, I really got excited about the technology, and I just kind of fell in love with it. So when I was working with these companies, one thing that came clear to me was that many of them, the only outside advice they ever got to that point was from attorneys. So they hadn't, you know, unlike these big, gigantic corporations, they hadn't hired consultants. They may not have even hired accountants yet. They certainly haven't hired, you know, PR firms and things like that. But almost all of them had attorneys. And the attorneys were kind of an integral part of the process as we dealt with them. That was interesting to me. So when I decided to go to graduate school, I'd always planned on doing a business degree. Northwestern has a nice program where you can do both degrees, law and business, within 3 calendar years, which is, you know, less time out of work and, you know, less money out of my pocket to go get both degrees.
That's a fast pace because usually law school itself is 3 years.
3 years alone usually for law school, but they're able to do both degrees in that same time period. And so I said, look, I should try this. It'll only cost me an extra year, and see where this goes. I wasn't sure, you know, I was still kind of young. I hadn't seen the full picture of that part of the industry. So as I was going through it, I realized that even though I didn't love all of the legal classes that you learn how to litigate, and they train you to think like, you know, like a lawyer, as they say, I really enjoyed working with doing the kinds of work that I got exposed to in my internships. And that really just led me to realize, look, I can go do this thing that I had seen these other attorneys do with these small tech companies. I can go work with them at a very, fairly early on in my career, you know, and I can make an impact because a lot of them don't have big teams of other outside advisors, and, you know, really just get my hands dirty and help these companies from a very early stage. And that's what I did right after school. I went to work for a firm called Wilson Sonsini. They're a Bay Area firm. They've been there for a long time. They've kind of done this.
One of the top 2 or 3 firms. They were the firm that took Apple. We mentioned Apple
earlier.
That's right. They were the firm that took Apple public.
And they represent Google and HP and a bunch of companies, that household names, but they also continue to do a lot of work with very early stage companies. And they had an office here in Salt Lake that I got to work with some fantastic attorneys, fantastic mentors. And so, you know, as I worked through that, I was able to kind of get the skills, get the training from kind of a blue chip firm, but then it got to a point where I realized that, you know, there are some bumps along the way for political issues with some of the partners at the firm. But, you know, eventually my group landed at a regional firm here in town. And what I realized was that there, you can take one or two approaches. One is you be a big brand, and you charge high rates. And, you know, companies sometimes are willing to pay those rates because they like the brand. They like what a big behemoth firm brings to the table. Or you can go lean. we didn't see enough. And our hypothesis when we started our current firm, me and two other corporate partners at the time.
Who were the other two?
So one's name's Curtis Oskarson, and the other one is Matt Romney. Curtis Oskarson was my partner, one of my coworkers at Wilson Sonsini when we started, and so I've known him through our career. And then Matt Romney, we had come across him a couple times. He was close to joining us, our group, at some point. And so we just kept in touch from there, and we would all come to the same conclusion at different points in our career that, maybe the big firm isn't the right fit for these small tech companies that need more agility and they need lower costs and they need more involvement with than just coming in and working on transaction and then leaving and not hearing from each other again for months, years. So that's what we did. We decided to start our firm with the idea that we're going to get more involved, try to keep our costs down so that young companies can afford to call us and afford to use us in between the financings. And we just have loved it. We've tried to keep our vision, despite growth and despite the pressure to keep expanding, to kind of capture a lot of the work that keeps coming our way because of the way we're structured. We've made a conscious effort to stay lean and stay focused on the early stage companies and, do what we love to do. And, we love to do it. And that's why I get up every morning, because I love working with these companies. I love the excitement they bring. I love the new things that the vision that they have. It's not this big tired corporate structure. It is a lot of these entrepreneurs have a vision for very life-changing, culture-changing things, and they have to have that vision to be successful. They have to believe in it to be successful, and that's contagious. It rubs off on me, and it makes my day more enjoyable. And then I get to use some of my training in business school, because I'm, one of their only advisors. In many cases, I'm asked to respond to questions that are well beyond what an attorney normally would respond on. So that's really exciting for me as well. But, I just love what the community has done here in Utah. And Doug, and I know you're a big part of it, and the other investors in the different pockets you'll find in Park City and in Utah County and Salt Lake. I mean, it's been wonderful to see this growth over the last 10 years and be a part of it.
It is. And, you mentioned the community. We're here at the post-celebration from StartFest down in Provo, Clint Betts event. It's just great to see what's happening in the ecosystem. And what I really like is we all do a little, and collectively it makes a big difference. You mentioned the fun and the excitement of the companies. It's fun to see that happening. And Utah is lucky to have this resurgence of entrepreneurial companies going on here. It's really exciting.
It's fantastic.
And Utah is also lucky to have attorneys like yourself and your law firm and all the other players that help support the entrepreneurs in their impossible task, really, of building these companies. Kudos to them. We just mentioned also StartFest.
Kudos to them. Yeah.
Kudos to StartFest. It'll be a couple weeks after StartFest when this airs, but that was a great event. Congratulations, Clint. Wade, thank you for sharing your story with us today on The Bottom Line.
It's great to be here. Thanks again, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Our guest this morning has been Wade Bean, a corporate partner at the Kunzer Law Group. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. Thanks, Ross. You can hear my entire interview with Wade on our website, kcpw.org. You can tweet me, at Savvy Wells, or at KCPW Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.